In Pennsylvania, the actions of some Catholic bishops are now under heavy scrutiny following a stunning report from the state attorney general's office regarding the widespread cover-up of priests sexually abusing minors. The investigation outlined how hundreds of priests may have abused more than 1,000 young victims, and bishops may have worked to keep the situation from coming to light. One of the witnesses in that case was James Faluzak. He grew up in Erie, Pennsylvania, and eventually became a priest himself. He has also testified how he was groomed by his parish pastor as a young man. The pastor waited until a particularly vulnerable moment before turning into a sexual predator. James Faluzak is no longer a priest and now lives in Buffalo, and he shared his story during a recent visit to WBFO. We've seen what's happened in Pennsylvania with the Attorney General's investigation. You feel it should be done in New York State as well. Tell me, you know, what goes behind that rationale for you.
In 2004, in the wake of the Boston spotlight revelations, the bishops of the United States conducted a self-study in conjunction with the John Jay College of Criminal Education in New York. And every diocese in the United States self-reported on the number of abusers that they had on file, as well as allegations, etc.
Okay.
And there is a discrepancy when you compare the self-reporting of most dioceses with the reporting that happened either through media investigations or local investigations by district attorneys, or in some cases, like Suffolk County, for example, I believe New Hampshire, and certainly Philadelphia, they had their own either county grand juries, or in Pennsylvania, they had a diocesan state grand jury investigate Altoona Johnstown in 2013. And once you look at the data that comes out of any type of investigation, whether it's formal by law enforcement or informal by media folks, there is a marked contrast between that data and the self-reporting of the bishops.
I want to just get onto this real quick, though. At the same time, we've heard similar accusations about the Buffalo Diocese as well.
Absolutely. So, for example, with the self-reporting of the Buffalo Diocese in 2004, the leadership of the diocese was in transition at that point. Bishop Cunningham was Vicar General. Monsignor Cunningham is the one who presented the John Jay self-report data for Buffalo. And at that time, he identified – or I shouldn't say he identified. He neither identified nor named the abusers, but noted that there were 53 priest abusers in the diocese in its history at that time, which – stands in contradiction to Bishop Malone's recent revelation of, I believe, 42 names. That immediately piqued my curiosity, because how is it that this self-report that had such authoritative weight behind it, how is it that Bishop Malone's number actually ended up being lower by 11 abusers? And furthermore, either with the John Jay report or Bishop Malone's recent number, they didn't give names necessarily at first, or certainly did not give assignment histories or the locations where the abuse took place. It took media folks, perhaps from WBFO or print media or other television stations. Now the number is between 60 and 80, depending on what outlet you're talking about. But it's twice the number that Bishop Malone is suggesting.
And is it as simple then, from what you're saying here, as saying that we just cannot rely on these dioceses to do accurate, thorough self-reporting?
You cannot trust the bishops to accurately self-report. You cannot trust them to be transparent in their revelations. More often than not, of course, there are exceptions. Some bishops really have taken this by the horns, but those are exceptionally rare. In Pennsylvania and New York State, there are really no instances of where bishops willingly presented that detailed information. It had to be dragged out of them.
I'm asking you to speculate on something that's got to be almost impossible to truly accurately speculate, but you're in the ministry as well, right?
Absolutely. For 18 years, right. I was an active priest.
So you have an understanding of the hierarchy inside the church. What's preventing, what's stopping these bishops from acting what does seem to be in an honest fashion?
When we talk about clergy sexual abuse, we're talking about crimes. We're talking about a vile sort of perversion and horrendous tragedy. And ordinarily, we're talking about between 7% and 10% of total historical clergy within a diocese. But there's a much larger dynamic and a much larger secret that gives cover to this. And it's important to note that this is kind of, it starts out as a different category that you'd probably be very understanding of until you realize that it gives cover to the criminal activity. There is all kinds of qualitative research to suggest that between 40 and 60% of priests are sexually active, either with males or with females and with adults on a consensual basis. Most of us would not even find that forgivable. Most of us would find that understandable, that sexual expression is a normal human need, the need for companionship, the need for that kind of love on a stable basis. No one would begrudge anybody the need for that. And so I want to say that I'm understanding of that, and I'm understanding of priests having that impulse and acting on that impulse. I don't fault them for that. The problem is that priests promise before their communities in a very public way to remain celibate. And they live that way. They carry themselves that way. When I was in ministry, it wasn't unusual out of 7 days to have 5 or 6 days that were 16, 18-hour days. And so celibacy really serves not only a spiritual function, which I'd be happy to talk about because I value it, but a very practical aspect of it is that it frees you up to minister to God's people. And what spouse is going to be comfortable with, you know, their partner being on call like that 24 hours a day and actually on the ground working 16 hours a day? But what happens is, as I experience this, when a priest is sexually active with an adult on a consensual basis, it's a secret that they have to keep. And when half of the priests in a diocese are engaged in a lifestyle such as that, that's a massive secret that a bishop has to manage. And I suggest that to be a bishop today, one goes into that job already prepared to be able to manage that secret, to be able to navigate that with their priests, because some of that's going to come out sideways and sometimes it's going to be known publicly and there's damage control that a bishop would have to do or whatever. But a priest who's sexually active with an adult, let's say they have a friend who is a priest or a coworker or a housemate who is sexually active with children that you'd regard as a predator, they then are unlikely to blow the whistle on that behavior because they risk having their own material brought forward and it wouldn't just end their professional career. It would end their life, their daily life as they know it for decades, rightfully so. I think it's important for us to recognize that, yeah, here's this basic human need that half of all priests are trying to fulfill or satisfy. But whether it's inadvertent or not, it gives cover to these predatory behaviors.
Final question, James. We'll go behind the curtain, so to speak, here for a little bit. You've been here now in our studios for well over 2 hours. You were doing interviews with NPR and another large public radio station as well, and now very graciously sitting down to spend a little time with me. But I'm just, rather than get into what happened to you, how are you? How have you dealt with the history that you have behind you?
There's been no part of this that's been easy. To talk about, for anyone to ever conceive of talking about their first sexual experience publicly, most of us would shudder at the thought. Most people are not in any way exhibitionists about their sexual lives. And for those of us who are victims, our first sexual experience was as children with men who, on behalf of God, took us by the hand and groomed us and made us feel that we were becoming closer to God. And in my case, mine swooped in on me at moments when he knew that I was vulnerable. And so for me, this is as much a matter of what Father Martin did to me physically. Obviously, that stands to reason as being hugely impactful. But the spiritual fallout of this, and obviously the emotional fallout too, is hugely significant. But this is regarded oftentimes by other advocates like myself as being the murder of a soul. This has hobbled my ability to trust other people, to trust people in positions of authority, especially religious figures in positions of authority. And that made it untenable for me to be able to work with the bishops in my diocese, especially because it was evident that they were engaging in cover-up. But this has hobbled my ability to trust God. And so obviously in all of that, imagine the impact that it's had on my ability to trust myself, my own conscience, to know my own mind and to be sure of myself. I've, at different times in this struggle over 30 years, I've been in therapy, and I've almost always been talking about this with trusted friends, and even throughout the seminary, priests that were charged with either my formation or my spiritual life. But many times, multiple episodes, I've performed triage by using substances, abusing alcohol primarily, and crawling into a bottle to numb the pain. And that resulted in a trip to rehab in 2008 that really gave me a wonderful opportunity to be around other survivors and to begin to talk about, to have a language to be able to even and talk about this. But I've really struggled with numbing the pain at times when it creeps up. Right now, I'm lucky to have very good emotional supports. I have everything that I need in that regard, and in terms of staying sober, and also other survivors in the Buffalo area that I talk to on a daily basis, and oftentimes we meet as a group. So I feel like I have my moorings that way. But there are triggers oftentimes, and certainly the process of participating in the grand jury in Pennsylvania was among those triggers, and the anticipation of the report and then having to face the delays of its release and the redactions and worrying whether or not my allegations were going to be redacted. I stayed sober throughout all of that. And I'm grateful that I have, but it's trying. It's difficult.
James, thank you very much for your time.
You're welcome. Thank you.